Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I've been incredibly fortunate over the years to get to spend time with a whole bunch of fascinating people. When you're fortunate like that, those people stick with you, sometimes in ways you didn't expect. You fall back on little nuggets of wisdom, you recall ways of thinking about language or history, or you remember some deep insight into an aspect of the human experience. And if you're really, really lucky, sometimes your paths cross again. Today's guest is one of those people. More than a decade ago, I got to work with him when I was doing my master's degree at the National University of Ireland, Galway. I have so many fond memories of working in his office and translating St. Augustine. So, as I was researching this current series on prehistory and the early historic period, I ran across a book title that sounded fascinating, Achilles Beside Gilgamesh, Mortality and Wisdom in Early Epic Poetry. And lo and behold, I recognized the author's name. Professor Michael Clark is established professor of classics at the National University of Ireland, Galway. He's an exceptionally wide-ranging and creative scholar who's worked on the Homeric tradition, Latin literature, Middle Irish literature, technical linguistic questions, and certainly not least, heroic epic, which is what we'll be discussing today. Most recently, as I mentioned, he's the author of Achilles Beside Gilgamesh, Mortality and Wisdom in Early Epic Poetry, about the nature of the striking parallels between the Homeric tradition and the Epic of Gilgamesh. Those are texts based on your emails and tweets to me that I'm sure many of you have read over the years, and I promise that Professor Clark's insights are going to make your head spin. Professor Michael Clark, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, and it's very good to see you again, Patrick, and to talk to all your people.
Okay, so let's start with heroic epic in general. How do we define it? What are its characteristics? How does it vary from language to language and period to period? It seems like an incredibly broad category.
It is a broad category. It can be deceptive in how unified it seems from the outside. And although it varies enormously, although it seems to occur as a category independently to the human spirit at different places and times, one factor that keeps recurring is the backward look. The pessimistic look back by poets and audiences to an earlier time, specifically a time when men had more energy than they do in these lesser times, more vitality, more abundance of life. They might be depicted as closer to the gods. That makes them admirable, but they're also dangerous. They're also in a state that's fraught with peril in a way that our weaker vitality avoids. And they're fraught with peril because although the men depicted in heroic epic can be admirable, they can be brave, they can be self-sacrificing, that same abundance of energy can turn them towards anger, even towards madness, and ultimately towards self-destruction.
That's really fascinating. I had not thought about heroic epic as a nostalgia or a commentary on present times, but I suppose that's true of pretty much all literature.
Well, literature doesn't get by just celebrating. Mm-hmm. You know, it explores, it probes values, and it raises problems and doesn't necessarily address them. Mm-hmm. So although heroic literature has too often in the Western tradition been treated as a mere mode of celebration, as a statist literature, as the stuff to give the troops before battle, I think when we delve into it in its cross-cultural manifestations, we always seem to hit the core moment of questioning, of probing, and of doubting.
Something that was really striking in reading through your book was the extent to which ambiguity is central to heroic epic, that it's essential to the Epic of Gilgamesh, that it's essential to the Homeric tradition, that these are not the kinds of texts that are going to give you easy answers about the human condition.
That's been the most revealing realization of all for me, and I hope for those I've worked with, students and so on over the years. And the image I keep returning to is one that an old teacher of mine, Christiane Servino Winwood, used to use, which she would think of ethics or culture in general, as a net cast over experience. The most serious and most profound and most enduring literature isn't the strands, the square strands of the net It's the interstices, the empty spaces in between. And she used to talk about the interstices of established belief. And I think that in its European manifestations, heroic literature is above all concerned with the interstices in between the need for young men to be sent out to die for their country and the darkness that can come upon them and those around them when that happens.
What's really fascinating to me is it seems like that core value is present over a wide range of places and times. And so I remember the first time I read the Aeneid as an undergraduate, and I read it with a wonderful instructor whose name escapes me because it's now been 18 years, I think. But he really drew our attention to when Aeneas is looking at these images of past glory, and the phrase that Virgil uses is an empty image, like a figura inanis. I can't remember exactly, but something along those lines, that like this image of glory does not actually contain anything. And it's this incredible piece of ambiguity.
I think that the stories themselves are what endure most, what remain most. And they sound in the distance, they sound in outline, as if they're glorifying the great men of the past. Mm-hmm. And that can be the case. I think that where particularly the study of Latin that you mentioned has lasted in the Western educational tradition, it's mostly been in that context. This is something that's set up, a literature that's set up to be admired. In its own time, in the heat and dust of an ancient city, everything is infused with political tension, with difficulty. Empire is never merely glorified amongst any people or in any literary genre either. It's always questioned. And I think that the greatest damage to ancient literature has been done by the modern desire, the desire that was very common, I think, amongst, say, for example, the people who taught me or the people who taught them up to 100 years ago now, the desire to treat it as tame, to treat it as a tradition or a set of traditions that validates existing political and social structures and makes them comfortable. I think high literature has always questioned. And that was true in the ancient Near East, in Mesopotamia, where the heroic epic tradition began 4,000 years ago and more.
From your perspective, if there is a unity to heroic epic as a genre or a category of analysis, do you think it's that kind of act of questioning?
The only unity that I can find, the only unity that I can really believe in this, is the unity of reception. The pattern that's affected the formation of national literatures and national literary canons over the past 200-300 years, when a nation steps onto the world stage, as the Greeks did in the 1840s, as the Gaelic Scots did in 1770s, 1780s before that. When a nation steps onto the world stage, there always seems to be an urge to set up a national literature. And in that national literature, a foundational text is chosen to say, this is going to be the text that speaks to our origins. So in Greek tradition, the epics of Homer always carried that role. For the Irish, it was the great medieval saga Tón Bó Cúalnge, which many of us study in another aspect of our work. For the English, it was Beowulf, the early medieval saga that became repackaged as a national epic of the British people. Mm-hmm. And that process of canonization keeps rolling out from nation to nation, and it creates the illusion that the history of literature is the story of single language stories, one nation, one language. I feel that what's far more vital and far more important is the intermingling and cross-influencing between languages and between peoples, that it's on the margins, both in antiquity and much later on, and in modern times too, but it's on the margins between population groups that creativity was always at its greatest.
So you mentioned Irish heroic narratives, and I know that this is something that has been very meaningful to you over the years, and you've spent a lot of time working on it. What drew you to those Irish narratives in the first place?
I think there was an awareness that the old story we were brought up on, the story that says there's one language equals one culture, there was an awareness that that story was wrong. That story had to be recreated. But the high seriousness that one sees replicated again and again from one heroic literature to another, that's real, that's there. So for many that I've been privileged to work with over the years, and for myself, our urge was to replace the old statist, culturally right-wing discourse we were brought up on to replace that with something that didn't throw out the seriousness of their reflections on mortality and the death of young men in battle and the sorrows of the world that heroic epic literature brings with it. And I guess that's why I called my book, I subtitled it, Mortality and Wisdom, because the last thing I wanted to do was to lose hold of that high seriousness that drew me to this literature in the first place.
This kind of work has been foundational for you, and you've gone all over the world in terms of your interests and the kinds of texts that you've looked at, the work that you've done. What do you think are the benefits of doing that kind of explicitly comparative work?
Well, I think it teaches a lesson that's never been expressed better, in my view, than by an archaeologist whose work I've been using recently called David Wengrow. And in his marvelous little book, What Makes Civilization, he's thinking as a field archaeologist who first worked in Egypt and also in what's now Iraq, in Mesopotamia. And he keeps emphasizing in that book that civilizations, with a plural word, they're not multiple. This notion that you've got a series of civilizations across the world competing with each other, that's a false impression. What matters is the single process of civilization, which is a process of learning and acculturating. And I guess something that's been described very well by Cardinal Hume, the English theologian, who used to talk about the vocation to become more fully human. And I feel that in the literature of the ancient Near East, in the literature of Greece, and in the other heroic literatures that we've talked about already, we can see different versions, different manifestations of that same desire to become more fully human and to understand the human condition better.
It's so funny you mentioned David Wengrow. I actually just interviewed him a couple of weeks ago for my show. He's a lovely guy, and I'm really excited about his new book on prehistory that's coming out later this year. But his work was mind-blowing to me in terms of the way that it just kind of reoriented my perspective around what quote-unquote civilization is and where it can come from and just what the process can look like. There don't have to be any single paths leading you anywhere, that the roots of the past can live on in for a very long time in unexpected ways. I thought his work absolutely blew my mind.
Well, I'm glad, because I find that audiences are sometimes a little disappointed to hear that the past is messy and that we're here to restore the full messiness to it. But I think approaches like that teach us that in messiness is where the truly humane and the truly profound can be found.
I could not agree more with that. I want to come back to something you mentioned a little while ago about the interactions between groups, between quote-unquote civilizations. And rather than looking for kind of single and exclusionary national traditions, we should be looking at the interactions between them. And that's the basic point that Achilles Beside Gilgamesh begins with. It's now uncontroversial among specialists who work on this period and place and time, but it's less so among the general public that there are these really close connections and confluences between cuneiform literature in Mesopotamia and Greek literature. So what has led us in the direction of that conclusion?
The story begins in a depressingly imperialist context, because it was in the early decades of the development of archaeology as a science that small groups of first English and French and then American archaeologists were able to dig in Mesopotamia, in what's now Iraq. And if we were to point to one key moment when the veils came back, when our horizons were opened, it was the moment when the scholar who was working on one of the cuneiform tablets that had come back from what was in fact the Epic of Gilgamesh found a description of the flood story narrated about himself by the character Utnapishti, found a series of motifs that were exactly the same as those in the story of the flood of Noah in the Old Testament. That made newspaper headlines at the time because no one expected it. Everyone thought that the Hebrew Bible, classical Greek, classical Roman literature, people thought of that as self. That's us. That's Europe. And people thought of what was being dug up out of the sands of Iraq as something completely other, completely different. East is east and west is west. And that moment suddenly made them say no. Intermingling, cross-fertilization, and hey, we think of the Babylonian captivity, the time when Judaic culture was infused with the experience of being by the rivers of Babylon. Of course, it's natural that the cross currents in the great culture area of the ancient Near East are going to be much stronger than the artificial divisions that imperialist regimes, or for that matter, later educational systems impose upon them.
you make a point that seems so obvious in when you're thinking about it in these terms, but that the cultural barrier between Greece and the world to the east that goes all the way to the Iranian plateau and beyond, that that's much more a product of the 6th and 5th centuries BC in a very specific cultural political context than the earlier period of Homeric tradition. The Greek world lay at the edge of this kind of extended culture area. It wasn't separate from it. So do you think that is it the Persian Wars that give us initially this sense of disconnection between those two? And, you know, kind of later commentators have picked up on that and built on it and turned it, like, kind of reified the distinction?
It's partly the extreme moment of the Persian Wars, and it's the memory of the Persian Wars coincides with the formation of the kind of literature in Athens that later became canonical in the educational system. But although the flow from east to west, and indeed from west to east, characterizes so much of what's going on at the local level, the unofficial level, the movement of peoples, the movement of slaves, the movement of poets and priests and wonder workers, movement is natural, must be key to the meaning of all the things we call civilization in that part of the world. But yet think of all the barriers, all the walls that have been built. One of those is the cultural wall that the Athenians and their allies built in and after the Persian Wars. Another, perhaps more powerful one, is the wall that was built in the self-representation of Byzantine Greek civilization in the earlier centuries and the middle centuries of the Christian era, with the rise of Islam in the East and then the great fear of Ottoman conquest in Europe. I think that those artificial barriers that have been placed on our apprehension of cultural flow have been reinforced one after the other. And I think that the colonialist barriers that were imposed in the settlements made in the 1920s after the end of the First World War and the collapse of the Turkish Empire, those barriers only went to cement the prejudices and the sense of division that characterized the study of classical Greek language and literature right up to our own time. And we're only beginning to peel those barriers away and think about what happens when we put the whole variety of the ancient world back in the mix.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
It's such a fundamental distortion of the world as it was, if we're thinking about the late Bronze Age in particular, to treat the Greek world as somehow part of the West or as a part of Europe. There's very little connection between what's happening in Mycenaean Greece and what's happening in Northwestern Europe at the same time. They're vastly different worlds that are not connected to each other in any meaningful way. There's a reason why in the most recent scholarship on this, the Mycenaean Greece is treated as part of the Bronze Age Aegean world rather than as part of Bronze Age Europe. There is no chapter in the Oxford Handbook of Bronze Age Europe on Mycenaean Greece because it doesn't belong in that world.
It becomes obvious when it's stated, but the difference is asserted, and something very special did happen in the southeastern Mediterranean in, let's say, the 8th, the 7th, and the 6th century. And I think it has a lot more to do with the rise of alphabetic literacy than any one cultural or ideological phenomenon. There are so many writing systems across the ancient world, as you know, I think, better than I do at this stage, yet there is none that is so easy for children to learn as the alphabetic writing system that we see for the first time in Greece and that we basically still use today. And I think that, although I don't want to say that there's something unique or that there's some kind of unique European excellence about writing either, I do think that mass literacy begins in what we've learned to call classical Greece. And that is fundamentally different from the way cuneiform writing operated in the ancient Near East.
It's really hard to overstate how specialized early writing systems were, how specialized cuneiform writing was. And I'm really excited. I'm going to interview an expert on cuneiform here in a couple of weeks, and I've got many questions for her about this precise issue. Moody Al-Rashid, who's at Oxford, I'm very interested to ask her questions about this, but it's especially the further back you go that these are administrative systems. They're administrative tools. The first complete sentence in hieroglyphic writing does not appear for 700 or 800 years after we see the first signs. There's the proto-cuneiform signs don't even know what language it is because there's no connection to phonology. The scripts of the Indus Valley, it's hard to make head nor tails of them in a phonological sense. So I think you're onto something with alphabetic writing marking a turning point. It's such a flexible system that can be used for so many different things. When you have direct correspondences between sign and sound, that opens the technology to people.
Which is important for thinking about the abilities of peoples to trade with each other as well. Of all the archaeological sites that speak to this sense of a permeable confluence across the Aegean Sea, there's none more powerful than the Olaboran shipwreck, which is about 1300 BC, shows that there's trade going all the way around between the Aegean, the sea between Cyprus and what's now Syria, and so on. And it doesn't just speak of trade, because one of the artifacts found in that shipwreck is a small writing tablet, which is a profound indication, even within Greek mythical and quasi-mythical tradition, who brought the letters of the alphabet to Greece but Cadmus, who's the Phoenician. In other words, we might now call him a refugee from Syria.
When you're trying to explain how these parallels occurred, there's this really haunting image that you evoke. A future poet in archaic Greece, he's lulled to sleep in childhood by a slave woman who had heard stories of Babylonian narrative literature prior to her abduction and sail to the West. And this is precisely the kind of thing that we always suspect happened, and happened at scale, too. The more interconnected the world, the more you would expect to see these kinds of interactions, but for which we only have the barest kind of evidence. I mean, so as we're thinking about this, what other kinds of interactions do you suspect that took place along these lines, but which, again, we would have trouble seeing?
Of course, that image of the slave woman, as I think you've seen, was pure speculation on my part. And I was trying to think there about the voices that become lost in subsequent tradition. And I think it's especially true in antiquity and in all threatened linguistic traditions that women's voices have been lost far more easily and far more readily than those of men. It's true, and as it happens in Gaelic Ireland as well. We could speculate forever about the voices of women and of slaves passing between city-states and between linguistic horizons in the ancient world. We could think also about traders, about soldiers. The great Swiss classical scholar Walter Burkert, who was one of the first to really foreground the question of connections between Greek and Mesopotamian literature, he used to think about wandering poets and wandering shamans, miracle workers passing, almost kind of, he would think of them as passing out of the steppes down to the Mediterranean world. Speculation again. I think at the same time that we've got to remember that the most powerful voices for spreading between worlds are those of multilingual individuals. Again, it's the European nation state of the last few hundred years, and it's true in your country too, that has created the idea that you've got one state, one people, one language. Antiquity was much more like modern Africa, countries like Nigeria, in the sense that it will have been typical for most individuals to have been multilingual. Mm-hmm. So multilingualism between speakers of Greek and speakers of Latin, it's just one particularly obvious example of that cross-language flow that characterizes really the whole pre-modern world. And it's in that context, the context of unacknowledged and unofficial translation, that I think the movement from one storytelling tradition to another would have taken place.
With regard to classical antiquity in particular, I mean, J.N. Adams wrote an enormous, it's literally an enormous book on bilingualism and the Latin language that is chock full of examples of bilingualism between Latin and practically every other language that could have possibly conceivably been spoken in the Roman world. And the precise nature of those interactions at a technical linguistic level, even leaving aside the conceptual aspects that go along with that.
Yes, and the same is spectacularly true in ancient Mesopotamia, mm-hmm. where between Sumerian, which is really a learned language, more like Latin than anything else, between Sumerian and Babylonian, from Babylonian to especially and most obviously Hittite in what's now Turkey, you have a constant culture of translation, of merger, and a kind of eclecticism, bits and pieces from individual languages being pieced together to form new learned registers and learned levels. We need to think of that kind of transference as fundamental.
I want to come back to something you mentioned a moment ago about losing the voices of women and slaves, because it reminds me that when I was working with you many years ago now, we worked on St. Patrick's writings, and you made the point, which I don't think anybody had ever made to me before, that St. Patrick's writings are notable for a lot of reasons, but one of them is one of the very few texts from the ancient world written by a former slave.
And thank you for remembering that, and it's a salutary lesson that the slaves were everywhere. Women were everywhere. And it's true that, say, from the Greek language itself, there are perhaps, from pagan Greece, perhaps 3-4 voices of women surviving directly. But within the literature created and mediated by men, we see images at the same time. Within the Odyssey, one of the stories told by Eumaeus, one of the characters in the Odyssey, is all about the slave woman who was foreign, who looked after him when he was a child, being taken, stolen from one people, traded to another, moving across the ancient world. We've only just scraped the surface to see how pervasive the messy flow between languages and between cultures must have been.
That's one of the things that makes me very hopeful for the use of scientific methods in analyzing human remains, is that when you can look at markers like ancient DNA and you can look at stable isotopes and dietary analysis, that you can get a much better sense for that kind of messiness and movement in the past in a way that textual sources and even artifacts don't necessarily allow for, because you can get past a kind of a skein of assimilation. And when you can put all that together, when you have individuals who have moved, who have gone from one context and place to another with what looks to be kind of assimilation in the sense of artifacts, it allows you to tell much more interesting and complex stories about people.
And one of the most significant of those story patterns is that of the emergence of difference, the emergence mm-hmm. of a speech community who see themselves as different from others, can take on uniquely creative forms in that way. And that's true, I think, of how especially the classical Athenians constructed themselves. And of course, true of how the Hebrews constructed themselves in the witness that they bore in the later centuries BC, when the Hellenistic Empire, most obviously Ptolemaic Egypt, was again a place of endless cultural merger and fusion and multiplicity. But out of that come the voices of a people like the Hebrews, who see themselves and are represented as a nation of philosophers with a different story about their God, a different story from all the other multiple polytheisms of antiquity. So out of that mixture, uniqueness arises.
I have a question about the nature of these connections between Mesopotamia and the Greek world, this kind of broader Bronze Age Aegean world that we're talking about. Why do you think, in terms of scholarship or maybe kind of quasi-popular views of the Homeric tradition, it's so much more common to see parallels with the broader Indo-European tradition than it is to focus on that specific context, that time and place? I mean, that you constantly see parallels between the Homeric tradition and the Vedas, or with Germanic epic or what have you. Much more common to see those parallels, I think, is my sense, than it is with the actual world in which these tales were being told.
I guess that depends what educational, what academic framework one is used to. Individual scholars have tended to orient towards either a linguistic approach focused on the filiation of languages in the Indo-European family from each other, or a more literary cultural approach, which more emphasizes unities of time and space. I think that the Indo-European hypothesis has its problems, not as a hypothesis about origins, but as a characterization of how language families operated in knowable time. I have no doubt that there is nothing in ancient Greek self-awareness that lays claim to an affinity, special affinity, let's say, with Romans, say, right, as against peoples in the Semitic-speaking population groups to the east. To the Greeks, they're all barbarians, and the same was true of their attitude to Celts. Similarly, in medieval Ireland and in medieval Wales, nobody realized that their languages were closely related to each other, and in fact, they both regarded themselves as having originated in separate ancestral peoples, again in the ancient Near East. I think that the prejudice in scholarship against Greek Mesopotamian connections has been heightened by the fact that Akkadian is a Semitic language and Sumerian is a language isolated with no relationship with others at all. So in the academy, there's been a feeling that if you want to read Mesopotamian literature in the original, you go off and do it in a different faculty. And that prejudice, I think, is one that scholars in our own time are only beginning to get away from, and that's full of exciting opportunities.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
I want to turn back to the Homeric texts for just a moment. And one of the things that you point out is how difficult it is for us to grasp how the words and themes would have been perceived by the audience whenever that audience existed. Because it's so much earlier in time than other pieces of Greek literature, we don't have the additional information, so to speak, the additional texts that allow us to create a world in which that plausibly existed. It's much harder for us to see that. So is there any way of getting past that? I mean, we've talked about the ambiguity, we've talked about the interstices of the cultural tradition, but is there any way of trying to understand how it would have landed, I guess?
It's difficult. And one insight that my own old supervisor, Jasper Griffin, used to share back in the day, and I'll share it with your people, is that Homeric epic always seemed ancient. It always seemed like a voice from an earlier time, representing the values of an earlier time and depicting the world of material culture of an earlier time too. We used for that reason to perhaps overemphasize its ancientness as a literary genre. I think most would say now that Homeric epic actually originates pretty close in time to, for example, the single voice and even choral lyric poetry that we have from Greece. And there are many inscriptions, including verse inscriptions, probably composed not long after the Iliad and the Odyssey took their present form, maybe five or six generations. But what's special about epic poetry is that it represents itself as drawing on the reservoir of a much earlier tradition, a tradition that comes not from sight and direct knowledge, but from the higher wisdom that the poets are given by the muse, the goddess of poetry. So in that sense, it's archaizing. And I guess that's why I emphasize the backward look at the beginning, because that's the recurring theme of archaizing and recreating a lost past that seems to characterize heroic epic everywhere.
So there's one specific set of parallels between Gilgamesh and the Iliad that you really focus on. So it's that the protagonists have this status between mortal and God. They're striving for immortal fame, but that this striving leads to the death of the best friend, and the protagonists are forced to turn toward the certainty of death. How should we understand those parallels? How do you think those arise? You spend a fair bit of time in the book drawing out contrasts between isolated borrowings and part of a kind of a deeper phenomenon of interconnectedness. So where do you stand on that? How should we understand those parallels?
I think the first and most valuable thing to do is to realize that literatures like this, literatures that are separated from us by such a vast gulf of space and time, become more meaningful if we read them alongside each other. And what I set out to do when I wrote that book was simply to act that out in practice, rather than by folding myself over one poetic tradition and trying to understand it inside out, to set two alongside each other and see what happens with the clashes, the confluences. The theme of a man who is two-thirds immortal, one-third human, that theme of proportion and ambiguity between those two states, that kind of liminality, that occurred in exactly the same way in the two epics. So you're thinking, first of all, Gilgamesh and the Iliad are similar. They're obviously emerging from similar ways of thinking about the relationship between God and mortal and how you project that back on the remote past. And then you get the theme that the great American scholar David Halperin used to call the hero and his pal, the semi-divine warrior and his lesser companion, lesser in the sense that he is less glamorous, less glorious, less obviously divine, and he's a moderating influence. Found that again in the same two places. You're feeling this might be coincidence. This might be a kind of convergent evolution between two traditions that belong in the same place. But what was staggering about putting Gilgamesh and the Iliad alongside each other, and this was really realized clearly for the first time in the 1950s, was that when the best friend dies, the hero in both epics, Achilles in the one case, Gilgamesh in the other, reaches out, embraces the dead body, feels for the heart, finds it's not beating, and then he's suddenly compared just for a moment to a lion. A lion whose cubs have been stolen from it by a hunter. Now, we might have said that that's just a floating motif. We used to use that phrase a lot, as if, of course, motifs don't float. Stories are told by individuals, but you might think it's just coincidence that the same image appears in the two epics. But when the overall structures of the narratives are so closely parallel, and when there are then precise identities of imagery at the same point in the story, when you add to that example I've just given of the lion cubs, you add a series of others that occur between the two, I think most I would agree nowadays that that goes beyond a randomized sort of coming together of two roughly similar traditions. That's a creative mind shaping his story, his epic, by thinking about the other earlier epic. And crucially, within the Iliad itself, in book 9 of the Iliad, one of Homer's characters, Phoenix, does exactly that. He takes Achilles' story and sets it alongside another myth, as it happens in this case, a Greek myth, the myth of Meleagros. And he fits the two stories in parallel against each other with the ominous suggestion that just as Meleagros died young and needlessly in one of those stories, so Achilles will die in the other. So far from it being an extravagance or a willful desire to break down traditional cultural forms to say that Gilgamesh and the Iliad are closely linked, are paralleling themselves with each other, it's fair to say, as my friend Bruno Curry has argued so well in another book, it's fair to say that Homer himself does that in setting up parallelisms between existing stories. You could read the Iliad without ever realizing that it's so close to Gilgamesh, but when you set Gilgamesh alongside it, it becomes more meaningful, not less.
I think one of the things that can be difficult about studying literature, I suppose, as kind of a layperson, as not a literary scholar, is to understand the connections between literature and the broader world, to get past ideas of floating motifs and to humanize it, that these are stories that are told by people in particular contexts, they're written down by people in particular contexts, they're shaped by experiences they have and stories they hear and things that they believe or the things that they wish weren't so, that it can be hard to combine those two things, the text and the world. From your perspective, when we're dealing with worlds that are this far in the past, how can we do that? I mean, I know that's a big and kind of a broad question, but how do we humanize the literature and make it more of the world?
That, I guess, is the science of philology. Scholars like Sheldon Pollack in the United States, who've done such a valuable job, I think, of preaching in recent decades, how the effort of reaching a scientific understanding of ancient languages and their transmission in textual form and manuscripts and so on, it's an activity of decentering, of moving away from the cultural norms that characterize your world and mine into a different value system. But it's a value system that is not merely primitive, not merely irrelevant. It's very other. It's very separate from the norms that we've come to expect. But there are also continuities and receptions and chains of influence that mean that the effort of understanding a language and a literature utterly different from our own nonetheless impacts on how we understand ourselves and how we face the political and ethical questions of our own time.
So it's the act of making the comparison and the act of learning more than it is the content of the thing that you're studying that makes the difference.
Absolutely. I would never say, and I think there are very few scholars in this field nowadays who would say that there's something uniquely wonderful or ennobling about ancient Greek literature or any other. What we would say, I think, is that the constant effort of trying to think ourselves into the language and into the cultural worlds of the ancients is a humane and generous activity, and one that maybe takes us away somewhat from the follies of our own time.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. And as a way of kind of getting to this broader point about humanizing, I want to quote you directly. It's from the conclusion of your book. It's a fantastic summation. And you say, quote, "Gilgamesh and Achilles begin from the compulsion to exalt oneself above smaller and weaker men, to achieve an everlasting name and avoid disgrace above all things. But they are led, and they lead us who contemplate them, towards the truth that the heroic ideal slips away in face of the instabilities of mortal life." So, viewed in this light, these two heroic narratives are much less heroic than they are an attempt to get across this very specific nugget of wisdom. How do you think that would have resonated? Because, I mean, the traditional image is warriors sitting around hearing stories about warriors. Do you think that's right? How do you think the people who were listening to this or reading this would have understood it?
That image that you mentioned, that cliche, I guess we can call it, or that topos of warriors on the eve of battle listening to heroic tales so that they'll fight more gloriously the next day. Of course they did it. But nearly all the evidence for that activity that survives within epic poetry itself. And that's true in Mesopotamia. One of the very earliest Gilgamesh tales has him listening to heroic songs himself at his feast before he goes out the next day. It's true in Homer. And it's true in the medieval epic traditions of Northern Europe as well. The literature I'm working on now in medieval Irish literature, it's in a heroic tale itself, Cath Albana, that we have the image of the kings and the warriors listening to heroic tales on the night before battle. No doubt they did. No doubt there's truth in that. But it's part of the self-invention, I think, of a learned literary tradition, one that's replicated again and again throughout the history of the West and Asia, that image recurs, and the image, I think, validates and gives meaning to activities of literary and poetic composition that maybe were less public, less popular, and more self-reflective amongst the learned. Mm-hmm. So the literature of action becomes a literature of reflection, and probably made sense in that way in its own time. What's miraculous is that both in Mesopotamia and the lands around, and later on through alphabetic writing in Greece, a few epic poems, of which Gilgamesh and the Iliad are just the most famous, became a staple for educational reflection and educational study in subsequent centuries. Mm-hmm. And what we'll never know is whether it was pure literary excellence that brought that about, or something more like coincidence.
It's deeply fascinating. When we were thinking about this, the idea of somebody taking like the first Rambo movie, which is of course a deep meditation on the damage that war does to people and how it affects them afterward, and turning that into the kind of story that people tell themselves before battle. I'm just struck by the ambiguity of that. At any rate, Professor, thank you so much for your time. This was an absolute pleasure to chat with you and catch up. This book is fantastic, and I just learned so much from reading it. Brought me back in all the best possible ways.
Well, thank you very much, Patrick. It's been a pleasure to talk. And I would just say I hope your listeners are having an enriching time. And it sounds like you're all having a fascinating time following this journey through the ancient world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA, or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.